You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 288 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens. As well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. It's the beginning of the month, so we start with Jeanette Marantos' Plants column, published on April 1st, 2025, a simple way you can actually help save the world. Welcome to April, the month of renewal, when we honor the earth with her own day, April 22nd, much like Mom on Mother's Day. Don't panic, that's not until May 11th. If only we could restore the earth with flowers and a nice brunch. Okay, brunch probably won't help, but renowned conservationist Douglas Tallamy thinks we can help save the earth with a few flowers, provided they're keystone species native to our region. Below, you'll find a list of Earth Day activities and other ways to celebrate plants in April. But first, I want to talk about Tallamy's hopeful ideas. A longtime professor entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware, Tallamy helped kickstart the native plant movement in 2007 with his first book, Bringing Nature Home: How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. He made it more personal in 2020 with his book, Nature's Best Hope: A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. His new book, How Can I Help? Saving Nature with Your Yard, available April 8th, lays out the problems and how to fix them as plainly as I've ever read them. Here are a few of his main points. Biodiversity, i.e. the rich variety of life on Earth and all its interconnected interactions, is key to human survival. Human development is destroying the Earth's biodiversity. We need insects to keep our plants pollinated and support the food web that keeps birds, lizards, and other animals alive. Lawns provide almost no habitat for pollinators and other insects. In the United States, about 83% of the land is privately owned. About 40 million acres is planted with lawn. We can restore biodiversity in the U.S. if we plant native species on half of that private land, even if the plants are growing in pots on balconies or patios. If we plant keynote native species, which around Los Angeles include oaks, coyote bush, manzanitas, ceanothus, buckwheats, and sages, we can get the biggest bang for our buck since those species support so many insects and other wildlife. Bottom line, if each of us just reduced the size of our lawns by half and replaced half of our non-native ornamentals and invasives with plants native to our region, our neighborhoods could provide the habitat all our threatened pollinators, birds, and other wild creatures need to survive. I can hear some of you saying, bugs are nasty. Why should I care? Well, how do you feel about all the plants that require pollinating to reproduce and survive? Famed biologist E.O. Wilson has called insects the little things that run the world, Tellamy writes, and without them, we would lose 90% of our flowering plants, which would cause the collapse of nature's food webs and the loss of birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians. Global insect populations have dropped by 45% since the 1970s, apparent to anyone who remembers the days when flattened insects covered your windshield after a long drive. The spread of pesticides is part of the problem, but so is the decrease in plants that insects need to survive, fed in large part by our obsession with perfect weedless lawns. Tellamy and his wife purchased 10 acres of old farmland in Pennsylvania in 2020. Ever the entomologist, Tellamy noticed a dearth of insects and birds on his property and wondered why, which started his investigation into the native plants that once dominated his land. The farm had last produced hay, had few mature trees, and was overrun by non-native ornamental plants. Today, Tellamy writes in How Can I Help, he and his wife, Cindy, have counted 1,323 species of moth and 60 species of birds that have bred on our property, the only two groups I have counted so far. The return of life to our land has happened in just a few years for one simple reason. We put the plants back, or at least some of the plant species that used to call our lot home. Our success made me wonder what would happen if everyone put the plants back. And if you focus on keystone native species, which provide food for large numbers of animals, you could make an even bigger impact, he said. Many Lepidoptera are picky eaters and will dine only on certain plants. Monarchs, for instance, will lay eggs only on milkweed plants because that's the only food their young can eat. The adults in their winged stage are happy to sup on any number of nectar-producing flowers, but without milkweed, they can't reproduce. That is why people who love monarchs urge us all to plant milkweed in our yards. And that's great, Tellamy said, but all private property owners, even those of us growing plants on a balcony or patio, can get a bigger bang for our buck if we also plant keystone native species that support a multitude of life, such as coast live oaks, which feed more than 100 types of moths and butterflies. If space is an issue and you live in Southern California, look for native plant varieties selected for their compact growth, such as Pigeon Point Coyote Bush, Baccharis pilularis, speciality pilularis Pigeon Point, or Island Sagebrush, Artemisia nesciotica. Or consider growing common sunflower, which support nearly 40 species of moths and butterflies. Sunflowers also remove heavy metals from the soil through phytoremediation. They're very easy to grow, and they make everyone smile. Insider's alert. LA Times Plants is passing out packets of common sunflower seeds to newsletter subscribers or anyone who signs up for the newsletter at our LA Times Festival of Books Native Plants booth on April 26th, 27th. Come say hi. It's time to stop waiting for somebody else to fix the world. Anyone with even a speck of land can help restore habitat by adding native plants to their landscape. Our hope is that if people try it on a small scale, they will see results and be encouraged to do more in the future, Tellamy writes. Look at your yard or patio. How hard will it be to remove lawn from under trees or widen planting beds to mix native species among plants from another land? If you want to really go all in, visit Tellamy's Homegrown National Park website and add your property to the map of property managers pledging to add more native plants. The site helped me realize that while I have many native plants in my yard, they're less than half of the total plantings when you consider my fruit trees, vegetables, roses, and non-native flowers. Sigh. A gardener's work is never done, right? And honestly, most days, that's a good thing. So check out the CalScape database of California native plants. Take advantage of the native plant sales listed below, or visit some native plant gardens on tours listed below or in our Spring Garden Tour Guide. We move now to upcoming events. On April 3rd, Propagating California Native Plants from Cuttings, 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Theodore Payne Foundation Nursery in Sun Valley, led by Horticultural Director Tim Becker. Participants will learn how to start and grow plants from cuttings and leave with a flat of 50 starts for their own garden. All materials provided. Tickets are $92.55, $81.88 for members. Eventbrite.com is the website. And the website is spelled EVENTBRITE, one word. April 4th and 5th, Ventura Botanical Gardens' second plein air paint out, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Gardens in Ventura, involves more than 30 artists painting around the grounds. Admission is free on Friday, April 4th, and $7 on April 5th. Members enter free. The website is one word, VenturaBotanicalGardens.com. On April 5th, Frogtown Flora Second Spring Open Farm Day, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the farm in Eagle Rock. Wear sensible shoes to explore Kathleen Ferguson's urban flower farm built on a slope. The tour includes vendors selling nature-inspired goods, locally sourced seeds, sourdough pizza, and Thai food. The new lower garden includes an adopt-a-plant area for visitors. The tour is free, but you need to sign up for an email newsletter for specifics about the location. The website, one word, KathleenFerguson.com. Apricot Lane Farms Rewild Your Landscape Native Plant Sale, also on April 5th, 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. at the farm in Moore Park. The plants have been propagated from native perennials growing on the farm. The website, Apricot Lane Farms, one word, .com. Also on the 5th, Wearable Nature Art Workshop from 1 to 2:30 at Descanso Gardens in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. Multidisciplinary artist Melissa Meyer, whose work is featured in the Daphne's Wardrobe exhibit at Descanso Gardens, leads a class in using natural materials to create wearable art. Tickets are $50, $40 for members. The website is one word, DescansoGardens.org. April 5th and 6th, Saddleback Valley Bromeliad Society, Bromeliad Plant Show and Sale from 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Sherman Library and Gardens in Corona Del Mar. The show is free with $5 admissions to the garden. Members and children 3 and under are free. The website is thesherman, one word, .org. April 5, 19, 24, 26, and 27, City Plants Free Shade Tree Adoptions permit Los Angeles City residents to adopt up to 7 trees for private use, from 8 a.m. to noon at Pacoima City Hall on April 5th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Marina Del Rey Middle School in Del Rey on April 19th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Bay Ramian Lawn in Northridge on April 24th, from 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at Augustus F. Hawkins Nature Park, and 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at Thomas Jefferson High School in the South L.A. neighborhood of Central Alameda on April 26th, and from 9 to 11 a.m. at Queen Anne Park, Mid-Wilshire. Cityplants.org is the website, and again, that is for Los Angeles City residents. On April 7th, Grow It Now, Warm Season Vegetables, a free class from 10 to 11 a.m. on how to grow warm season vegetables at the Sea Country Senior Community Center in Laguna Niguel, taught by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County, UCANR.edu. On April 8th, Integrated Pest Management, a free class in environmentally safe ways to manage pests in your garden, taught by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. at the Laguna Woods Library. Pre-registration is required, ucanr.edu. On April 9th, Roses 101, a free workshop about rose planting care and feeding from 9 to 10 a.m. at the Senior Center in Central Park in Huntington Beach, taught by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County, ucanr.edu. April 10th, Propagating California Native Plants from Seed with horticulturist Ellis Anderson. the Theodore Payne Foundation's chief botanical technician, from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Foundation's nursery in Sun Valley. Participants will use seed kits, reusable flats, pots, and plug trays, plus 10 species of cool season seed, while learning basic seed physiology, seed viability, and germination cues, all materials provided. Tickets are $92.55, $81.88 for members, eventbrite.com. On April 12th, the 4th Ventura County Wildflower and Weed Show and Spring Plant Sale by the Channel Islands Chapter of the California Native Plant Society, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Agriculture Museum in Santa Paula. The day includes speakers, information about wildflowers, invasive weeds, and pollinators, kids' activities, and an iNaturalist demonstration. Admission is free, and native plants can be ordered online through noon on April 9th for pickup at the spring plant sale on April 12th. The website chapters.cnps.org. Also on April 12th, Irrigation Basics for Native Plants, a walk and talk with Theodore Payne Foundation's horticulture educator Eric Blank to learn irrigation techniques from 2 to 3:30 p.m. at the Foundation Nursery in Sun Valley. Tickets are $39.19, $28.52 for members, eventbrite.com. Also on April 12th, Tree of Life Nursery Book Sale in California Native Plant Community Building to exchange plant knowledge, growing tips, and coordinate seed swaps. 10 a.m. to noon at the nursery in San Juan Capistrano. The website is californianativeplants.com. Bees, butterflies, and other pollinators, a free class about bee nesting habits, host and nectar plants, and ways to attract bees and other pollinators to any size garden from 11 a.m. to noon at La Palma Public Library in La Palma, taught by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County, ucanr.edu is the website. On April 12th and 26th, the Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy Native Plant Sale from 10:30 a.m. to noon on April 12th at the George F. Canyon Nature Preserve in Rolling Hills Estate, and on April 26th at the White Point Nature Education Center in San Pedro. pvplc.org is the website. On April 13th and 22nd, Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy 10th Wild and Scenic Film Festival, with two showings at noon and 4 p.m. on April 13th at the Cabrillo Main Aquarium in San Pedro, and at 5 p.m. on April 22nd at the Redondo Union High School Theater in Redondo Beach. Beth Pratt, Regional Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation, will discuss famed cougar P-22, the inspiration for the Wallace-Annenberg wildlife crossing during the April 13th showings, and cyclist John Siegel Bettner will answer questions about his pedal-powered adventures for people who can't manage them by themselves on April 22nd. Tickets are $15 if purchased in advance, or $20 at the door. On April 13th, 15th South Bay Waterwise Garden Tour, a self-guided tour of drought-tolerant and California native plant gardens in El Segundo, Gardena, Hawthorne, Hermosa Beach, Lomita, Manhattan Beach, Palos Verdes, Redondo Beach, and Torrance, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Proceeds will be donated to the Gardena Willows Wetland Preserve. Tickets are $10 and can be purchased online before April 11th or the day of the tour at 16116 Ardath Avenue in Gardena. Children 10 and younger enter free. The website is southbaywaterwisegardentour.com. And that's it for the first couple weeks in April. We'll highlight the next events in our next broadcast. Next article, also by Jeanette Marantos, was published on March 11th in the Los Angeles Times. While somewhat dated, there's some useful information in the article. Say goodbye to boring tomatoes. Where to find the most unusual ones for your garden now? March is prime time for SoCal gardeners who love to grow unique tomatoes. Three specialty growers are having pop-up sales this month and next in the greater Los Angeles area. They're offering a wide range of tomato plants in nearly every color, size, or shape. In case you didn't get the memo. March is tomato, zania, mania party time in Southern California, when specialty growers offer pop-up sales of hard-to-find tomato varieties, rain or shine. We're talking serious exotics with a range of flavors from smoky to sweet and evocative names like Thornburn's Terracotta, Cherokee Purple, Evil Olive Cherry, and Brandywine Pink. Cal Poly Pomona's 28th Tomato Zania plant sale begins Saturday, March 15th at the school's farm store in Pomona, selling more than 150 varieties of tomatoes, all grown by Cal Poly Pomona student employees, who are also plant science majors. Proceeds support the school's plant sciences program and the students. Its annual Pepper Zania begins in April at the store, with more than 150 varieties of peppers. And in May, it offers the hottest of the hot peppers during its ultimate pepper plant sale. Independently owned Tomato Mania is celebrating its 25th year of pop-up sales of tomatoes and peppers, offering more than 100 varieties of tomatoes at 13 venues between Santa Barbara to San Diego counties and Santa Ynez. Its first event began February 28th at Rogers Garden in Corona Del Mar, where remaining tomatoes are available through March until they run out. And other Tomato Mania events are scheduled well into April. Its venues for the remainder of March include Otto & Sons Nursery in Fillmore, March 13th through the 15th, Tapia Brothers Farm Stand in Encino starting March 21, Wachter's Hay and Grain in Ojai on March 29th, and Anawalt Lumber in Hollywood March 29th and 30th. And on March 22nd, 23rd, Joanne and Alex Trigo are reopening Two Dog Organic Nursery just for the weekend to sell 44 tomato varieties, 12 more than last year, at their Mid-Wilshire home-based nursery from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. both days. The Trigos closed the daily operations of their nursery in 2021, but there's just something about sowing lots of seeds at the beginning of the new year that I can't seem to retire from, Joanne wrote in her email announcing the sale. And true to their nature, the Trigos are also offering a few companion plants such as tomatillos, basil, and Persian cucumbers. Get in on these sales as soon as you can, but before you plant, be mindful of the rain, which we badly need after a very dry winter. Depending on how much rain we get, your soil might need a few days to dry out before you start planting, said Tomato Mania owner Scott Degree. Tromping around in wet gardens can compact your soil, making it hard for tiny roots to grow and water to penetrate deep into the ground. Degree has a long list of general tomato growing tips on his website, as well as tips for growing tomatoes in coastal areas and in containers. Two Dog Nursery has an extensive list of tips as well. Here are a few important reminders. Tomatoes love the heat and do best with at least 8 hours of sun each day. If you're growing in containers, however, note that too much heat in a pot can stress out your plants, especially if they're sitting on concrete or asphalt. So try to give them shade after 2 p.m. or so, especially in inland areas where temperatures regularly push 90 degrees during tomato season. Containers should be at least 15 inches deep and 15 inches wide to handle deep-rooted tomatoes, and have plenty of drain holes so they don't drown when they're watered. The best advice is buy a bigger pot, Degree said. Choose smaller sized fruits like dwarf or cherry varieties if you're growing in containers. Large varieties like beefsteaks will take a long time to mature and produce only a few tomatoes. Always remove the bottom leaves of your tomatoes so the plant doesn't touch the soil. This helps increase airflow to the plant and reduce the chance of spreading mildew or other diseases. If you want quicker results, buy tomatoes in 1 gallon containers. Remove the bottom leaves and plant them pretty much as deep as they were in the pot. You don't need to disturb the roots unless the plant is root-bound, Degree said, which shouldn't be an issue this early in the season. Tall, leggy plants with main stems more than 5 inches tall can be angled into the ground horizontally to encourage strong root growth along the stem. But plants with 3 to 4 inch stems don't need to be planted deep, Degree said. Some people like to add special things in their tomato holes, such as a banana peel for extra potassium as it decomposes. But at a minimum, Degri said, be sure to work compost and organic fertilizer into the bottom of the hole to keep your soil and your plants healthy. Add a bit more fertilizer and compost on top of the soil once the plant is in the ground, so those nutrients will filter into the soil when you water. One of the classes offered this month was about nurturing bees. Our next article by Cass Farrar was published on March 20th in the Financial Times of London. You can see a ballet unfold, how to nurture bees in your garden. There's something hypnotic and calming in watching bees going about their business. Nestling closer to the ground, attuning your ears to the unique hums of different species, and seeing the intricate design of pollinating insects feeds a deep hunger in which modern life has made us deficient, says Rachel de Thample, in-house fermentation specialist at Hugh Fernley Whittingstall's River Cottage HQ and co-author of the new River Cottage Handbook number 19, Bees and Honey. Beekeeping has become a hot topic. Habitat loss and climate change have wreaked havoc on the nesting sites of these environmentally essential pollinators. Since 1930, 98% of wildflower meadows in the UK have disappeared. Creating a landscape for bees and nourishing them is the best way to help, says de Thample. But striking a balance between honeybees, which are thriving, and wild bees is a key. The increase in people keeping honeybees in their gardens is putting pressure on the natural system, says de Thample. At the time of writing the book, London had the most congested bee population in the country. This can be detrimental, as well as creating competition for food among other pollinators as well as wild bee species, it can lead to increased levels of disease. You can enjoy bees without ever having to don a veil, and a pair of stout gloves offers Fernley Whittingstall, adding that there are significant benefits for wild bee nurturers as well as bees. The joy of seeing pollinators busy at work is a huge mood booster. At the most basic end of the spectrum is growing wildflowers. Bees love purple, blue, and pink flowers. They can't see red, apparently, but even an herb box will attract them. To encourage bee habitats, mow your lawn less. Join hashtag NoMowMay, the annual campaign by PlantLife, and allow your garden to grow wild. Those without a garden can look into supporting local pollinator pathways. Pesticide-free corridors of native plant life often set up by community groups and local wildlife trusts. You can see a sort of ballet unfold throughout the different seasons, says de Thample. It's beautiful and addictive and slightly less terrifying than having bees buzzing round you while you try to harvest honey. For honeybee enthusiasts, many urban areas operate beehive shares between local beekeepers. De Thample recommends the British Beekeeping Association and the Natural Beekeeping Trust as resources for getting started. Those striking out on their own, meanwhile, have a wealth of hives to choose from. Matt Somerville of Bee Kind Hives designed and built a number of the hives at River Cottage, all of which could be constructed at home. The rocket-like three-legged Freedom Hive consists of a hollowed-out log with a thatched roof, mimicking the natural tree hollow habitat of honeybees. The box tree hive, designed by Somerville and Fernley Whittingstall, seems the simplest one for any novice, suggests de Thample. It requires minimal inspection, which can introduce diseases as well as disrupt the temperature in the hive, which stresses the bees. And you don't want stressed bees. For the more ambitious, the Wara hive is constructed as a tower using separate boxes and wooden strips for the bees to build comb from. If I were to keep bees and harvest honey, this is the hive I would have, says de Thample. Additional boxes can be added at the bottom, allowing the bees to build new areas of comb to expand the colony. It takes an enormous amount of effort for a bee to produce even a teaspoonful of honey. Paying attention to their activity is a reminder to be mindful of what you buy and how you use it. It's easy to see why honey was once prized over gold. But should you harvest a good amount of honey, de Thample proffers some delicious recipes. a fig and feta salad, and fresh sardines with gooseberries and fennel fronds are both accompanied with a honey dressing, the making of which, should you prefer, need not require any direct contact with bees at all. Bees and Honey, River Cottage Handbook number 19 by Rachel DeThample and Steve Minshall, is published by Bloomsbury, £18.99. We close this week with a recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published on March 28th in the Financial Times of London, The In-Betweeners, What to Plant to Span Waning Winter and Surging Spring. Planting frenzy is beginning. Nurseries are open, those backbones of the biodiversity in British gardens. There's plenty to buy, and in Britain we are all still spoiled for choice. Before I start a new season's choosing, I like to go to a garden on a soil different from my own to see the last vestiges of winter and the beginnings of flowery spring. It makes up for what I miss on alkaline soil at home. Often I tune up for spring in the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens near Romsey and Ampfield in Hampshire. They are a shining example of how support from a local council can enhance ecology, diversity, and beauty. Harold Hillier, the garden's founder, died in 1985, but remains a titan among experts in trees and shrubs. He had an encyclopedic knowledge exemplified in the invaluable handbook, The Hillier Manual of Trees and Shrubs, which is an essential resource. His Hampshire nursery still supplies public and private gardens on a grand scale. Meanwhile, the Hillier Gardens, supported by Hampshire Council, draw in thousands of visitors yearly. They end a happy day with a bout of shopping and the plant center, which has been enlarged as part of the bigger whole. The Hillier Gardens can grow the camellias and rhododendrons, which at home I cannot. They have also been enlarged to include a winter garden. Its progress is an encouragement to anyone with room to follow suit. The winter garden was opened in 1998 and enlarged in 2014 to cover 4 acres. Visiting them, I signed off happily on winter before pursuing traces of spring. I especially admire the winter garden's combination of hellebores and heathers, ones which we can all grow, and the bare stems of a dogwood that is still vivid in March. The dogwood is Cornus sanguinea midwinter fire, an excellent choice whose clumps of fiery brightness illumine gardens until April when the stems come into leaf. It is extremely easy to grow, but like all brightly stemmed Cornus bushes, it should be pruned very hard next month to ensure young, vivid growth for next winter. Cut it right down to its central core of wood at ground level. In the Hillier Gardens, old plants with big basal roots were looking spectacular on a sunny Sunday. Pruned hard, they have remained about 3 feet high, easy to accommodate on a bank, say, up a driveway or in wilder parts of a bigger garden. Heathers run in front of them, a family I used to ban from gardens. I have learnt better. 2 years ago, I saw how that great planter of college gardens in the U.S., Beatrix Farren, chose heathers for the flower bed she looked out on from ground floor windows of her last country home on Mount Desert Island, Maine. Since her careful choices, the varieties on sale are so much better. They no longer look like skinny refugees from a Scottish moor. There are even good ones for gardeners on moderately alkaline soils. They are the named selections of Erica X. Darlayensis, a hybrid that probably arose in a garden with the help of bees. The Hillier Gardens use pink-flowered epi, but Ashwood Nurseries near Kidderminster lists an excellent range and supply by post. Take your pick, remembering that Silber Schmerz is an especially good white, one of those that flower continuously from late November until early May. What else spans winter and spring so generously? Behind the heathers at the Hillier Gardens, individual plants of the Corsican hellebore showed clusters of rounded apple-green flowers. Other hellebores have been so beautifully improved that this old favorite turns up less often, though it is extremely easy to grow. Like the stems of the Cornus, its flower stems need to be cut away after blossoming so that fresh young leaves can push through and make a bold clump of toothed greenery during summer. Nurseries usually list it as Heliborus argutifolius, but there is no need to buy a big plant. One young plant in a 9-centimeter pot will soon become a feature, and as an adult will seed many children round it. I could plant a garden like this one, I thought, never having done so, and in it the heathers and cornice would soon block out the weeds. Drifts of these plants with some big-leaved bergenias would look handsome for at least 5 months. Pondering the possibilities, as you should, I set off for the other side of the garden, set in 180 acres and segged into early spring. Spring in the Hillier Gardens means magnolias. Follow the discreetly chosen signing and head for the restaurant and German's house, the opposite end to the winter garden, and you will see what I mean. On the way, I had memorable encounters with many other items waiting to open as spring advances. The Hillier area now holds about 42,000 different plants. Hunting for camellias en route, I found a red double, Aldoff Odusson, in fine flower, one to mark as a first choice. It was named in 1910, and yet the Hillier bush is a reminder that it is still excellent, either in a pot or in a garden with acid soil. Wishing I could grow it, I walked back down the great double border, another post-Hillier addition, and was consoled that it looked no more lively just now than mine, except for clumps of the little yellow daffodil tete-a-tete, one I patronized too for the same purpose. I was then put back in my place by a yellow-flowered beauty that would never grow well on lime in the Cotswolds. Coreolepis pauciflora is a fine shrub, free-flowering with pale yellow bells and excellent in light woodland or lightly shaded places. Its more familiar name in the U.S. is buttercup witch hazel, but even as Coreolepis, it is readily available in Britain. It spreads rather widely, rather than vertically, but is never awkwardly big. I envy it, but at least I have been to Hampshire to see it at its best. On the rebound, I came to the high point, the big trees of Magnolia soulangeana that run up the main sightline from the windows of German's house. This broad walk first amazed me in April 1987, and this spring, as usual, the survivors are covered in hundreds of buds. If night frosts permit, they will be spectacular in the next fortnight, a sight worth a journey. After praising them in the FT, I learned that Harold Hillier planted them on the spur of the moment because he had a batch of soulangeana magnolias going spare. What looks pre-planned was planted on impulse. From an earlier visit to the gardens in April 1982, I first realized the beauty of pink magnolia, ex Loeb Nerney Leonard Messel, a Hillier favorite. The UK had just begun war in the Falkland Islands, a faraway dot in my stamp collection, but this fine magnolia took some of the puzzled apprehension out of the afternoon. I assumed, wrongly, it was difficult to please except in acid gardens, so I admired it and let it be. In 1987, stunned by the magnolia walk, I bought a Leonard Messel, and it is now the star of my garden, 20 feet high, well-branched, and happy enough in alkaline soil. A visit to a garden, a plant bought as a memento, and then years of patience. They are an excellent recipe for success. That wraps up edition 288 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program designed for and produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send us your comments at www.lars.org, L-A-R-R-S, or email us at one word, laradioreading@gmail.com. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, or planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky. Gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.